Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 87, where we are discussing Sun Tzu's book known as The Art of War, written sometime around the 3rd century BCE in China. This is part one of the episode where we will discuss the book, the context in which it was written, and how it has been adapted to contemporary matters. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
This is Dr. Ralph Sowell coming to you from north central Montana.
Hi, this is Sarah calling from London.
And this is Pedro coming from central Brazil.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Paul Kahn, also calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
Welcome, everyone. And also a special welcome to our guest, Paul Kahn, who's going to help us navigate this very interesting text. It's a text we're going to be adding to our collection on history and culture with an examination of Sun Tzu's The Art of War. This is an interesting text. We've actually talked about including something from the military canon for quite some time. We had originally discussed bringing in Clausewitz. Clausewitz is on war. There was also some clamoring for Sun Tzu. And what we decided was to, you know, kind of weigh the two and think which would be the better one to start with. And given that Clausewitz is a very, very long and complicated book, and Sun Tzu, The Art of War, is short, succinct, and very, very easy to read, we decided that perhaps Sun Tzu would be the better text to go with. And we choose this text also because this book has been used as the basis not just for military thought, but it also has found its way into business literature, popular business literature. If you do a search, book search, you will find the Art of War adapted for a whole host of purposes, the majority of which are management, but not exclusively management. So this is a text that has found its way into a lot of places. So we thought this would be a good text to start with, doing the usual Talking About Organizations thing, where we look at the text itself and then bring in the interpretation, because one of the things that we'll find is that there's a lot of interesting things in the text that might be overlooked. So we asked Paul Kahn to come join us. And Paul, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and also then proceed with introducing us to the text?
Sure. Hi, everybody. Once again, from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where it is a cold, icy, snowy, windy kind of day. So it's perfect for a podcast, in other words. So I'm a professor of national security studies at the U.S. Army War College. I've been here for about 16 years. My specialty varies from drug cartels to regional politics of Northeast Asia. When it comes to Sun Tzu and the Art of War, I was really introduced to it not in school, but through my father. So my father is Hong Kong Chinese. My mother is Irish Scottish from Australia, so it makes for some very interesting family reunions, to say the least. But he's the one who really introduced me to the Art of War, probably when I was in my 20s. So it's not something that I grew up with, but it's something I got very, very interested in as my graduate school career kind of went along. And then as soon as I was hired by a school in professional military education, as you mentioned, Tom, a lot of people are interested in Clausewitz, but they also wanted to have another cultural perspective on warfare. So Sun Tzu being sort of the obvious choice. And I happened to be around and expressed an interest in talking about the book. So, interest converged. And so I've been looking at it ever since. So again, my approach to Sun Tzu, The Art of War, is not from an academic perspective per se. Didn't go to graduate school in Chinese studies or Asian studies, but as kind of somebody who took it on, as he was learning his profession.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the history of the text itself, where it comes from and the context in which it was written?
Sure. So there is a lot of debate about whether Sun Tzu, in fact, existed. And if he did exist, is he actually two people rather than one person? And we can certainly talk more about that. The general consensus is that Sun Tzu's The Art of War was written sometime in the Warring States period of Chinese history. So the Warring States period would be anywhere, oh, let's say between 400 and 200 BC, which if you think about it, is a rather wide stretch. So somewhere within 200 years, this is when the Art of War was written. It really came into sort of Western hands via a French Jesuit in the 1700s. So the Jesuit missionaries of the Catholic Church, of course, going out to Asia to sort of Christianize a lot of folks. So this is where we get the Art of War as a title. And really, that's not the title of the work. I think Father Amyot, the French Jesuit, was trying to compete with Machiavelli. Machiavelli, who also wrote a text, you know, Middle Ages, called The Art of War. So I think he wanted to sort of link that back to a Western known figure or a known figure in the West and say, oh, look, here in China and in Asia, they also have somebody who wrote about the Art of War. But really, it's part of a literature in Chinese culture called Bingfa, the Bingfa literature. Bingfa, loosely speaking, loosely translated, means military methods. It can be translated a bunch of different ways, but that's perhaps the best way. So Sun Tzu's Bingfa, which is really how it's known in China and other parts of Asia, it's Sun Tzu's Bingfa, is really not the Art of War. It often is referred to as the 13 chapters because there are 13 chapters. And Sun Tzu, actually, his name tells us that he's a master of the Bingfa literature because Sun is his last name, although he probably changed his name. His original last name was probably Chen Wu. And Tzu is actually an honorific title. It's a title that is put on the end of a Chinese person's last name if they're so well respected in Chinese culture that you don't need to use their full name. So Confucius is just Kong Tzu. And so Sun Wu is just Sun Tzu, which also leads us to that question about whether or not he wrote, if he existed, Sun Tzu, because a lot of the bamboo strips, and when we talk about the book, the Sun Tzu book, it's really a scroll of bamboo strips. So, you know, if anybody out there wants to Google it and see what these strips look like and these bamboo scrolls, feel free to do it. It gives you an idea. There's actually where it says Sun Tzu, and then Bingfa. So it would be very rare for an author to proclaim himself to be a master of something. So it may be where somebody transcribed what he was saying and said, this is Master Sun's Bingfa, his military methods. So a lot of this literature, Bingfa literature, was nearly destroyed in 221 BC by a Qin dynasty emperor who thought that all books were dangerous to his rule, all learning. So we only have a very small fraction of this Bingfa literature remaining throughout China. So Sun Tzu's Bingfa is still highly prized. As I mentioned, I learned about it through my father, who told me that he received the Art of War as a gift from a cousin. So it's not unheard of in China or parts of Asia to actually get text of Sun Tzu's Bingfa as a gift or to give it as a gift. So hopefully that gives us kind of a broader context for the Art of War. And I'm you know, happy to talk more about some more of the cultural context. But if anybody has a question, happy to talk more.
One of the things that we can see is that, like, if you're reading this, you can almost picture that you're seeing somebody who's an advisor to a sovereign or to a general. Assuming that the transcription is wholly accurate and not a strong distillation, it comes across that way, that this is advice being given to leaders or sort of like a teaching. It's not an academic treatise trying to get into the whole science of it. It has a very, very practical, written very practically. And that also gets kind of into the some of the writing style, when we see how it's written together.
Well, my question for Paul was just going to be, as much as we ever could in history and historiography, if we could determine it was neither written by the master nor even transcribed and collected by one person, given what you've said about the reception and the reverence that most communities have for it, how do you think that might change, if at all, the way the text is received and used at this point in its life and its evolution?
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. That's a really good question. I don't see it changing much, the reverence or the respect for this text. if somehow, we come to a consensus that, Sensa didn't really exist, or it was really transcribed, or, some people have suggested that really the Art of War is a type of Betty Crocker cookbook of all the recipes of remaining Bingfa literature out there that some of the Qin Dynasty princes kind of threw together. It's like, okay, we have to figure out a way to just preserve some bits of this literature so we can make this book a distillation of all the remaining bits, all the bits that are important. And as Tom mentioned, and just to sort of reemphasize something, the book is not a theoretical discussion of what war is. It is more practical. It's for use, which is not like Clausewitz's On War is really trying to be a unified field theory of war. And the Art of War is not. So one way to think about it, and I sort of describe this to my students, is that Clausewitz is really a book about cooking, where Sun Tzu is a cookbook. Like a cookbook will actually have recipes and tell you how to do something. Here's what a successful baked Alaska is. A book about cooking will talk largely about cuisine, and it may have some recipes, but it'll be largely kind of cultural. It'll have some history in it. So that's how I sort of distinguish that. So because it is a much more practical text, and because, as Tom mentioned, it's been adapted for so many different purposes, Sun Tzu's, the Art of War for management. I've seen the Art of War for golfers, the Art of War for lovers. And then just recently I saw the Art of War and COVID, which I'm still kind of confused about. I don't know whether COVID is reading the Art of War and is using them principles, or Omicron seems like it's pretty smart kind of variant. So maybe it is. I don't know. So I don't really think it would change very much because it has been so widespread over so many years. Does that help answer your question, Sarah?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. It's a fine line between an expected answer that justifies our own feelings at this point versus finding the answer that history and ancestry would want us to say. And I think you walked that beautifully. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. That was very kind. Yeah, thank you.
Sarah's question made me think of my general feeling when I read the book, right? It was my first time reading it, even though it's so common. And I'm coming to it from a total, not even beginner, but a general person that doesn't know about military strategy. And I saw two things that are interesting. One, we discussed a lot of classics in the podcast here, right? And it seems that this book, like many other books in literature, seems to be the product or at least connected to a broader collective effort, right? There is a lot of talk today on how Homer was not really one person that wrote those big poems, but is the product of a collective effort of people singing those songs and poems, right? And this, at some point they got written down, and we know that Shakespeare, there is all the debates about, was it a person, a man, or just one person? But we know that all the stories there were more or less known, but was written in a particular way, right? So there's an interesting feature of classics, which seems to be that they are not just the product of lone performance, but they have this collective wisdom dimension. And the other one, getting to what you said, Paul, on the comparison between Clausewitz and Sun Tzu, which is that while it's a cookbook with recipes, one thing that I found was very interesting is that at many points, they are trying to probe the thinking much more than just say there is one thing that applies to all situations. Trying to show the dimensions and the factors on how one should go about considering the situation. And at least, for a total beginner, I think that was quite smart in trying to show the dimension of things you may consider versus saying there is something that applies to all purposes, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think we can all agree that Sun Tzu's Art of War is much better in the original Brazilian Portuguese. But, we have to make do with what we have with the Chinese, the classical Chinese. But I like this notion of a collective effort, because some scholars have made that very point about Sun Tzu's The Art of War, that if it was transcribed, then obviously there is more than one person at work there. And then you can also see over time some embellishments that have gone on, even with Sun Tzu as a person or some of Sun Tzu's sayings that are kind of popular but are not in The Art of War. Those are sort of head scratchers, if you will. So, one scholar has said that, well, this could be Sun Tzu's you know, put that in quotes, Sun Tzu's grandson, who wrote this other book and called it The Art of War to link it to his own Art of War, to make it seem like he came from a tradition of people who, and you know, sort of inherited this ability to talk about war and strategy. So that would be an interesting shaping of how we understand that text. And your other point about how it is, you know, whether it's generalizable, if you can sort of make it about almost anything, but maybe not almost about anything, but if it's so elastic that it can encapsulate all these other topics beyond just war, but it can talk about strategy for business, strategies for romance, then really how useful is it? If it means everything, does it really mean nothing? Or do we treat a lot of things within the book like metaphors? And we can certainly talk about that as well, because I think that there's actually more the discussion of in the first chapter about the kind of overall context of war and how we can think about it in ways that are more metaphorical and not just tactics, not just about, okay, what kind of terrain are we talking about? Should there be fire attacks? How do you use spies? So those things, I think, come from sort of broader palette that he's painting on.
Yeah, I think it may be worth talking just very, very briefly about the context of the Warring States period. When we say about why this book would have been written, you know, the Warring States period did last for quite a long time. And the Griffith translation, I should specify that we did read a couple of different translations of it, by the way. I read the Griffiths translation. Everybody else read the Giles translation. I think both translations have some of the context with it. But the Warring States period was a period of intense, constant war among a very large number of small kingdoms throughout what is now mainland China. And what we're talking about is this book is kind of like the outcome, if you will, of what seems to be the best way to approach war based on what was a couple of centuries worth of constant fighting. So when we talk about war, we're talking about a particular type of or character of war, which is particularly brutish, particularly devastating. I mean, it was more of a total form of warfare. Would that be a fair characterization, Paul?
Yeah, it certainly would have appeared to people of that era to be a total form of warfare, because it was also very different than previous warfare during that period of Chinese history, because there was also the disintegration of the emperor's power during the Eastern Zhou dynasty. The emperor's power becomes much more symbolic because of invasions from the north and conniving nobles within his own court. He's really kind of just given symbolic power. He can set the calendar. He can authorize certain days for festivals. He sort of grants permission for books to be written. But he's largely just kind of in the palace and just surrounded by people who are just trying to take over his power, trying to bleed his power a bit. So you have all these vassal states then, of course, that are pretty much left on their own. So they're trying to fill a vacuum. So as that political disintegration is occurring, there's actually a revolution in Chinese agriculture. So you can actually now sustain a larger population in your city. And if you can sustain a larger population in your city, you can field larger armies. So you have a larger armies, you have agriculture, you have political disintegration, and you also have walls that are built around cities. So you have siege warfare. That is something pretty different. And because of siege warfare, that sort of warfare, it's longer, it's attritional. There's a lot more human suffering that goes along with that. So if you think about one of the admonitions that Sun Tzu has about war, which is, you know, in that sort of rank order of what you should attack, the very lowest one is attacking a city. And that's largely the result of this change in politics, in agriculture, which then, of course, leads to a change in warfare. And also thinking about warfare. So all of these different, we'll call them revolutions or significant changes in military affairs happen because of three things: technology, thought, and organization. Some combination of those, or where one outstrips the others, or just runs away with the game that other competitors just cannot keep up with.
So with that, now we'll go ahead and talk about the text itself. And we've already made reference to the fact that this is 13 chapters. Now, a chapter, this is not prose, by the way. This is not traditional paragraph-style prose. A chapter consists of, I think the low end was like 19, the larger end was 60 bullets. I mean, statements. Each statement is numbered. So when you look at the first chapter, which is called Estimates, and this is where basically it's the introduction to the text, or basically setting the stage for the entire text, the grand maxims that Sun Tzu is saying, that had something I think it was 23 different statements. So the chapter itself is very short, 27 actually. And from there, each subsequent chapter sort of follows along with a particular topic. Chapter 2 is about the act of waging war. And one of the things we got to mention is that depending on which translation, the headers are going to change as well. But just, you know, there's a chapter on how you wage war, a chapter on how you go on the offense, a chapter on the posture of yourself and the enemy and what would be advantageous or disadvantageous. How to measure weaknesses and strengths is chapter 6. 5 is energy, which is basically how I would interpret that as sort of like morale. And it just goes from there. And what's interesting is that not all of the chapters read as a clean, straight text. Like if you put the bullet points into a paragraph, it wouldn't necessarily read cleanly. There's a little bit of jumping around. There's a little bit of discontinuity. Again, sort of adds to the sense of like, this is somebody who's speaking to an audience and someone's capturing it along the way, because there's some parts of it, there's disagreement as to whether or not somewhere in the transcription that the sentences were in a different order. But one thing I would mention is that I found it very interesting, the level or the effort put into this book in taxonomies. There's the 5 of this or the 9 of that, or it's almost like what you would see in a magazine rack nowadays, the 10 different ways of doing this or the 13 of that. There's a lot of that in this book, which I think helps with trying to navigate what it is that he's saying, because it's such a short, compact text, but it could be very easily misinterpreted, or you could very easily get lost.
It made me think while I was reading the original purpose for it. And if you think about training armies or cascading training, especially with the replacement rate from a long war, it would be useful to have a sort of field manual. And apologies to those of you whose profession this is, I will be using all of the wrong terms, but a field manual you could share with the rather uneducated, rather physical force that you have, however you have taken them on. And one of the points in the text itself is about subsuming your opponent's armies after you've overcome them. How do you get them on side? How do you get them to start to fight for you? I was thinking as I was listening through it, imagining how one way could be sort of a here's your introductory booklet, learn it. And isn't something that's numbered, isn't something that has these lovely short, clear sentences, very few different topics, lots of repetition in case you miss it. Wouldn't that be something that you could give to, let's face it, the soldier class that you get, not the elevated elite warriors, but the foot soldiers, especially back then, were those not doing the higher order work, you know, the famous civil service exam that took days and days. This is everyone who's left. And how would you pass on the principles and the strategies if you had to quickly out away from home and away from, in our cases, as academics, the classroom?
Yeah, those are great points. And I think you can see that in an interpretation in a movie called Red Cliff. And you can find it, I think, on Amazon. It's a Chinese movie starring a couple of Hong Kong action figures. And one of them takes on this, he's the Sun Tzu, he's the military advisor, and he's trying to educate this smaller kingdom that is about to be consumed by the emperor's much larger army. And it's like, okay, well, how do we win? And so that's exactly what you've described, Sarah. That he's trying to educate this smaller kingdom and its military on the practicality of indirect fighting, for example, or the use of spies. So how do we beat this large, we're outnumbered, We have a terrible geographic position, hence the red cliff. They're literally up against the cliff. So you can actually see how people interpreted just what you said cinematically.
So you already started touching upon some points that are very prevalent on the book, such as geography, the importance of spies, right? The idea of fighting smartly, so force in itself is not enough, but using your logic and your planning to your advantage. And all these things speak to us directly, especially as people that are familiar with ideas in organization and management, right? Strategy, planning, and so on. But I wonder how revolutionary was it back then, right? Because the attention he's paying to make the argument leads me to believe that these were ideas that were quite, yeah, revolutionary, path-breaking, right? Rethinking what war was really about and how one should go about thinking about that.
You know, good observations. There are two schools of thought on that. One is Sun Tzu is really, and whoever transcribed it, was really just mirroring what was already known in oral tradition. This is part of what we do. The other school of thought is, no, actually, this is revolutionary, that the other surviving Bing Fa works do not emphasize the indirect approach. They don't talk about attacking the weakness of the enemy. In fact, one of them talks about attacking the strength of the enemy, because once you destroy an adversary's strength, they are completely vulnerable to your will. Why would you ever destroy an enemy's weakness? That's kind of like, duh, you know, all right, but they're still strong. Yeah. So, and you can see that different interpretations in Asia, even when it comes to geography, the emphasis of geography or some of the precepts in the Art of War. So for example, a lot of China will emphasize the defense. So where if you are weak, you hide as if you're under the nine folds of the earth. Well, sure. China's a large country, so you can hide. You can hide wherever you want. In Japan, they emphasize the offense, that you should strike like a thunderclap, because Japan's an island. You don't. There aren't a whole lot of places you can hide. I mean, you could try to go to China, but then it's pretty obvious what's going on there. So even within geography, it'll get interpreted differently based on how that geographical context is of the culture in which somebody is in reading Sun Tzu.
Comment I was going to make, I think, just goes back a little bit to what Paul said earlier, which was that it's so general, and I don't think that's exactly a problem, but it's so general, at times you wonder, well, how do you even apply this stuff? And Paul was talking about the applications to other activities. And I think one of the things that makes it challenging, which is not a complaint, it's just the nature of the text, is that the language used is very culturally fixed at that time in China, where they talk about the five ways the armies can and have difficulties, or the five constant factors, which he talks about. So things like the moral law and heaven. And when I read heaven, I'm thinking, what does that mean? And then, of course, it gets defined later, but it was by the commentary that it got defined. So I'm not really complaining so much as observing that perhaps it's not the details of how you apply these things. It's more like the style of analyzing your enemy, understanding the terrain, understanding the biases to which you're prone, because he actually mentions that. That's mentioned later in the text. And I think that's some of what we're seeing here, is that I think Sarah had a really great observation, where it would be a good way to start out and say, okay, does everybody have this background? Or here's what we want, the background. We want a military leader and or his emperor, because there's a lot of guidance on how the emperor should relate to the general or their relations, somewhat indirect, but it's sprinkled throughout the book.
Yeah, so you could say this is an early treatment of civil-military relations. It's trying to hash out the relationship between the military and the civilian, quote-unquote, civilian leadership, even though a lot of leaders during the war and states period were warlords that would ride out with their forces anyway. But yeah, somebody whose expertise is in fact looking at military strategy and warfare. And I think you're right, Ralph, that you can sort of see a lot of these as metaphors, and a lot of the interpretations have been, well, what Sun Tzu meant by this was this. So, you know, when you look at, as you mentioned, heaven, well, what does heaven mean in this context? It sort of gets defined later on. That could be a metaphor for what we call the timing of an attack. So yeah, day and night, cold and heat, sequencing of the seasons. So that's really, that's about, you know, really when should we attack? And then D, which is Earth, which is the next sort of fundamental principle, is really about cost benefit. It's like, okay, well, what do we attack? So when you combine that with timing, it's like, well, what and when do we attack something? And attack can be also understood rather broadly too, can it? And you can also take out city and put in firm or company or, you know, business arrangement. What's the timing of that? You know, and should we pick up this portion of the business and not the other portion of the business? And I'm sure we'll have a larger conversation about that later on. So it may be that, yeah, we're looking at somebody who's talking in metaphors and also who is very good at using the numbers as a way for people to remember something, you know, nine folds of the earth, as you mentioned, you know, five different styles and nine different types of terrain or the different types of spies. I forget the number of different types of spies. So it may be kind of a, you know, an early form of clickbait, as Tom suggested. It's just a way for, you know, it's just a way for somebody to go, oh yeah, I wonder what, tell me more about these different number of spies, you know, go ahead, read from Master of Sun.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. That's an interesting metaphor, clickbait. One thing I'm doing now, it's coincidence because the way the episode, we scheduled the recording of the episode, but I just happened to be reading about the Battle of Gettysburg that occurred not too far where you and Tom are. And it really helps me think through the text. I'm on day three now and I just finished Pickett's Charge. And it really helps me think through a lot of these aphorisms and advice and recommendations because you can see them all throughout the battle, through accounts of the battle. And it doesn't really matter, I think, which battle you pick. You could pick any battle. I just happen to be reading about Gettysburg. But you can see in the text, he gives examples, in the Giles text, he gives examples from Napoleonic warfare and the Duke of Marlborough. And so I recommend to any readers who are reading this for the first time, try to be reading at the same time some other account of a battle because it'll really help the ideas come alive.
Oh, that's a really good suggestion, Ralph. I hadn't even thought about that. But you're right. When I was teaching at the Air Command and Staff College, which is down in Montgomery, Alabama, we took a staff ride to Vicksburg. And the battle of, you know, quote unquote, Battle of Vicksburg, all I could think of was somebody's been reading Sun Tzu on the Union side. This is a lot of deception. This is a city on a cliff, you know, Vicksburg overlooking the Mississippi River, siege warfare. And I'm thinking, man, I don't think we have any evidence that Grant or anybody, you know, had read Sun Tzu. There's some pretty heavy suggestions that Napoleon did read Sun Tzu when he was, you know, a young lieutenant boning up on strategy. But yeah, I think that's a great suggestion is to read this in tandem with an actual historical battle and see what actually speaks to you from that.
Right. And in fact, you mentioned Vicksburg, and I've read several accounts of that battle. And what went through my mind is that Grant actually defied one of Sun Tzu's most important aphorisms, and that's don't leave your supply base. And yet that's a famous action that Grant took in order to surprise and get around the... So he's actually combining different parts of him. What's nice about whether it's Vicksburg or Gettysburg is you can see how they work together, how these ideas work together. And maybe if it's a short departure from your supply lines, which maybe wasn't applicable in the time of Sun Tzu, but in the time of Grant, it is, oh yeah, you can do that. And striking like lightning and striking the enemy's rear. So that's, I couldn't resist mentioning that because I thought, well, that's not what Grant did, but it worked because it was short term. Yeah.
I would probably go one step further with a small provocation. And that's to say, now that I have been through the text, I recommend that no one reads it alone for a couple of reasons. One, which is with my teacher hat on, going back into the classroom again, there are so many times going through the text that you need someone to ask, is this really how life works? Is this really how war works? But also, is this reflecting our real values of society? Or why doesn't this fit with everything else that I've been told? And whether you read it in parallel to another text, like Ralph is saying, whether you read it in a small group, as we are doing, I really don't think this is something, compared to almost everything else we've been through, actually, that you can or should read it alone. Never mind the dramatic format and the dramatic background that we started with by saying it sounds a bit more like a soliloquy or a lecture than it does a written text or a flat text, as we would call it. And there's one that says, for example, I'm in chapter 4, number 11, and the translation here says, what the ancients called a clever fighter is one who not only wins, but excels in winning with ease. And that speaks to my own research interests, which we've discussed on this podcast before, about it's not making separations or dividing echelon among the already elite. So here this lesson says, no, you don't only have to win and you don't only have to dominate the opponent, but not crush them, but fold them in, but take all their supplies, but leave them hobbled. You need to win and you need to win with ease. So no, you don't get to survive and write a text that talks about how hard it is and how bold you are and how excellent at war you are. You have to make it look easy.
Great point.
So that's when you get to a point where if you're on your own, or if you have no skill or no background, let's say, and you're taking this in as your foundation, you just have to nod along and say, right, I need to win and I need to make it look easy. Okay. And here's how I do that. Hence the victories bring him neither reputation for wisdom nor credit for courage. Surviving and passing along your genes and not becoming a prisoner of war is all you get. You don't get any of this glory, which of course is very Chinese, right? You don't get to be proud or glorified for any of this. But if you're reading it not from the first text you've ever read and yet still alone, you are having that conversation with yourself, which means you don't deepen your understanding and which means you can't build that critical distance because you have no way to have literally another voice in that conversation. So for those of you listening along with us now, we can be that other voice for you, but I would encourage you not to read it or not to even listen to this conversation alone.
Yeah, that's another great point, because it's almost the mirror image or the other side of the coin from what Pedro mentioned, which is this notion of if writing this was a collective effort, then perhaps interpreting it is also a collective effort as well, where we can sort of sit together and try to unpack it and perhaps write our own commentary, you know, on some other bamboo scrolls or something and stick them in a cave somewhere in Eastern Montana. Yeah, I like that a lot, because obviously we each come from a different background, different cultural context. And so we will likely see something in it that, you know, another person may not, and vice versa.
So I have something on that, right? When I was reading, I think I was reading it in two levels. And one was reading as the text is and looking at some of the specificities of the content, right? More of the things about what war is really like and how one should conduct oneself in that situation. But I saw a lot of points, and I started with a list of how what Sun Tzu was trying to bring resonates of what we know about organization and management, right? There is certainly something about, as you just said, Paul, the separation between civilians and military, and I think more specifically about the rulers and the military commanders, right? There's something about the organization that one would expect of an army and the importance of spirit to corps and what we call today motivation. So there's something about managing morale and looking at the organizational behavior aspects of the army. There's something about strategic planning. There's something about leadership. And to go back to what something Sarah just said about this attitude that is not just valuing winning for its own sake or this kind of macho brute force. And here's my Latin American background, it's trying to speak against that, right? And say that one should try to be as astute, as cunning, winning through different means than just asserting oneself. So I read at this level and seeing all these potential connections and aspects that is being brought to discussion of war. But at the same time, in different chapters, it got very nitty-gritty. And Ralph and Paul, you already discussed how one can look at military leaders or even battles and see that there seems to be a glimpse of some of these ideas there, right? So I was wondering what extent what this text says, and I'm speaking to the military expert here, right? Has this found its way in this context, right? To what extent all these ideas have been picked up and inform particular, I don't know, schools of thoughts or strategies or ways of thinking about the military organization?
Yeah, this is where, you know, Tom and I can certainly have a conversation, probably more Tom than me, when it comes to the organization of the military per se, and how Sun Tzu may have kind of influenced particular aspects of it. You know, I'm a little leery of saying that Sun Tzu has had a big impact on the U.S. military. Outside of the occasional quotes or quotations taken from the book to inform some bit of doctrine per se, and I'm thinking mostly Air Force doctrine, interestingly enough, then, you know, it hasn't been as impactful as we might think. What do you think, Tom?
I agree with you. So what I would say is that whenever we find ourselves in a situation where conventional warfare is the dominant part of conversation, then you're going to hear a lot of more Clausewitz. When conventional warfare is less of the conversation, then we're going to hear a lot more Sun Tzu in the discourse. It's a false dichotomy, and that's one of the things we've got to be careful about. Because Paul's right. There are a lot of things in this book that lend itself to thinking about organizations and organizational design, and not just the military. But when I look at it, I'm definitely mindful of the discussions that Sun Tzu has in various parts about, as a reminder, that if you're going to undertake a major campaign, for example, then you better be properly resourced for it. And that was a very resonant theme at several points within the book, that if you're going to undergo something, then you better be prepared to expend the resources. And so then this also gets into the logic behind why indirect approaches or some of the other things that he advocates for is in essence to try to avoid attriting yourself to the point where even if you win, you don't want it to be a Pyrrhic victory. You don't want it to be the kind of victory that says that, you know, you're stuck. You can't fight and do anything else because you know that other competitors are going to take advantage of your weakness if you exhaust yourself in the process. And that's why protracted wars are generally not preferred, for the very same reasons that Sun Tzu says, because they exhaust you, they leave you vulnerable and that sort of thing. So there is a lot of discussion about, you know, that we undertake, and we try to get away from this dichotomy, this false dichotomy about one author is about one type of war and one author is about another type of war.
Well, that's where I think I agree with you, Tom, that it is a false dichotomy because it's a mix of these kinds of things. And I actually wrote a note down at the beginning of the text. He makes the comment that one of his aphorisms in laying plans, which of course plans are, I'm trying to remember, is it Eisenhower or somebody said, planning is everything, plans are nothing, you know, that kind of stuff, which I'm not claiming was influenced by Sun Tzu, but he says, as circumstances are favorable, one should modify one's plans. I mean, that's not a bad encapsulation of that, you know, plans are nothing, planning is everything kind of thing to understand that. And I think back to Pedro's comment about how you can extract a lot of this stuff for business, what I see is an undercurrent below the you should do this and set fire to that and talk to spies this way, which I think were all important in his time. It's a really interesting breakdown of the parts of warfare or the parts of some significant enterprise, and then how those parts fit together, and that you should know the details. And that's how I think you could extract these kinds of things. And I love that comment about attritional warfare, because he makes a comment in spies. It's a really interesting idea, this idea that the leverage you get from spies, and it's a tiny investment of the total expense of your army. So anybody who ignores whether you want to call it spies, intelligence, I would generalize it to intelligence in general, is that it's a tiny investment and a huge leverage for informing you. And I think that was it's a really interesting comment that he made related to spies, but I think he meant intelligence in general. And so would that be R&D in a business, or, you know, business intelligence stuff? I don't really know, but I thought it's a very interesting way to go about it.
I mean, one way to think about spies in the age in which Sun Tzu had written is Bing Fa is just as you suggest, Ralph, which is with a minimal expenditure. And it's also kind of piggybacks on a little bit of what Sarah had also talked about as well, with winning with ease. So if you can figure out what's going on in the adversary's court, perhaps you could bribe somebody in the court to open the gate at night and let your armies come right in. And therefore, you're not fighting at all. So there are a lot of ways, or to assassinate somebody who is the key figure in the opposing camp. It's like, well, who's really running the show in that particular kingdom? Well, it's actually not the sovereign, it's the prince, or it's actually the general. So yeah, with kind of minimal expenditure, minimal effort, and with minimal damage too. That way you don't have to lay siege to the city, expend your own resources, and damage the prize that you want to get. So if you think about it, Sun Tzu also in some ways is talking about post-conflict, you know, that sort of phase of warfare, which is victory comes at a cost. So even if you win, there's a price to be paid. You still have to pay that price. It's not just the adversary who's paying for your victory.
So this comment made me think that perhaps given the analytical capacity of Sun Tzu, and Ralph already, you know, told that he brings together considerations not only about design and structure and geography and intelligence and all these different elements, it seems that he's not even talking about war in itself, but the goal for which war is set up, right? Because your comment on post-conflict made me think of that. So it's interesting that although it's titled wrongly, We Discovered the Art of War, it's actually something that's trying to go beyond. And in thinking about war analytically, look at the purpose for which one would engage in war.
Yeah, I think that's yet another good observation, Pedro, because one of the reasons we can say, perhaps hypothetically, why this text is so elastic and so many people find it relevant, it's not about war, it's about victory, it's about winning, it's about achieving your goal, whatever that goal happens to be. You know, if it's business, the multitude of different objectives out there for business and organizations. If it's the art of war for romance, it's, you know, finding that soulmate. If it's golf, you know, I think there's actually one, the art of war for poker. So yeah, it's not about how do you use poker to wage war. It's actually, well, how do you win at poker so you can make money, right? So yeah, I think that's a really good observation. It's not just about war. It's about winning at this thing called war using strategy.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.